Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself
and for those facing homelessness,
because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas, big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Hello and welcome to Podcast Like It's 1999, the podcast where we talk about the films of 1999 from the front seat of a green Cadillac here in 2021. I'm one of your hosts, Kenny Nybart.
And I'm Phil Iskov.
And with us today, we're very fortunate to have documentarian, filmmaker, producer, Kirk Fraser. He did the 30 for 30 Without Bias, which I thought was an amazing film. And we're really happy to have you on the podcast, Kirk. Thank you for joining us to talk about this film.
Man, I appreciate you guys having me here, man. It's a pleasure. You know, 1999, what a great year.
Where were you in 99?
Shit. Worried about Y2K. That's you right. know, partying in 1999 like it was the end, because I think that's what a lot of us was really thinking about, that really came up in the whole internet and all that was really popping around that time. So information was really spreading. You know, that was the beginning of information spreading for us. So that Y2K thing really had people shook. You know, had my mom in the grocery store stacking things up, not knowing what was going to happen, you know? Yeah, it was a great year. It was a political year too.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, sure. Great films came out that year. Great things that covered cultures and all kinds of things, you know.
What we've noticed a lot is there was a lot of Y2K anxiety running through all the films of this year. Like some were blatant, like about the end of the world, and some were just this kind of like, you know, baseline undergirding of anxiety running through the whole piece. So, yeah, I think we all kind of felt that. And I think some people, certainly people who didn't really experience it, don't understand what that felt like to feel there's a pretty good chance the world might not end, but just kind of stop.
Yeah, something different.
Yeah.
We didn't know what to expect.
It definitely felt like we felt like we were approaching some sort of a precipice, I think, to some degree. I mean, it was just like this millennium thing, this whole, like, it felt like there was this, but it was also kind of exciting too. I felt like, I don't know about you guys, I was excited about the year 2000. I wasn't all that worried about Y2K, but maybe that's just me.
No, I mean, it was just no one knew what to expect. And then everything was so hyped up, you know? So, and the fear was there. So, and at that point we were not as much as we are now relying on technology for everything, but damn near that was the start.
Mm-hmm. It would have fucked us up pretty good.
Oh, right now. Yeah. Shit. Yeah, right now.
Oh, now it would be over. Yeah.
Oh, hell yeah.
But yeah.
Remember back then, the only way you got around was by MapQuest, and you used to print that shit out. So there was GPS in your phone?
Yeah.
When I moved to LA, I had a Thompson guide. Physical maps. I used to deliver flowers with a Thompson guide.
Different
time. Thompson guide.
Yeah.
you know they still make those?
That's embarrassing.
Yeah, they still make them.
Yeah, I feel bad for the Thompsons. I feel bad for all physical people. I feel bad for the Zagat's guide. I feel bad for the Thompson people.
Sure.
I feel bad for the Yellow Pages.
Oh, shit.
Yeah.
They all had their days. What about the guy that was selling the encyclopedia? What about him?
Oh, yeah. Mr. Britannica.
I first Google.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was such a dork. I used to sit in the library and read the encyclopedia.
Really?
Yeah.
Love that.
I had the luxury of having that shit at home. I never really looked at it until there was a school problem. You know?
I mean, I didn't like read it like a book, but you know, I would read it like I read Wikipedia now, which is, you know, all that I read.
Yeah.
But let's talk about American Pimp, film 1999, directed by the Hughes brothers, not necessarily known for documentaries. They had not just done Menace to Society. Where was this in their filmography?
I'm looking them up right now. I mean, it was pretty. I think it was like. Hold on one second.
I know this is probably like their third film because you also had Dead President that came out. You also had, Menace. You had things like that. So
you're absolutely right. It was Menace to Society 93, Dead President's 95, and then this in 99, and then From Hell in 2001.
They had two really kind of huge movies. Menace to Society was kind of paradigm shifting. They were obviously really hot directors. It's an interesting move for people who generally do narrative scripted film to move to a documentary at this point in their career. I wonder what you think about that move and what you think about the Hughes brothers in general.
I mean, I think they're dope. I always thought they were dope. You know, their work has always spoke to the culture in some ways. Definitely with Menace to Society. I mean, that shit was real in terms of the culture of what people may have went through and felt at that time. And American Pimp was a documentary version of the Mac. You know, mm-hmm. So and at that point, I mean, people were influenced by the Mac for years. So I could only imagine that they grew up in that particular part of time. I'm not sure if they're from Oakland or that area, but I mean, it's heavily out there as well. I mean, plus they always rep the culture from day one. So I wouldn't see why they wouldn't want to do a film that spoke to the underworld at that time, because pimping was changing, you know, in terms of, it wasn't the old ways, because before the drug dealers were the pimps. So, mm-hmm. And that was in the culture of the community as well. So you have to understand that. And their mindset were completely different than the hustlers on the corner. You know, their product was a woman. The product was sex.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I could only imagine. I never really had a conversation with them or have ever met them before, so I can't really speak to why they did the film, but you know, it definitely spoke to a culture and in general lifestyle.
Well, it's an interesting decision to me in that, you know, certainly Menace to Society and Dead Presidents are dealing with certain aspects of Black culture that basically white people either don't understand, can't understand, or probably shouldn't be making movies about. And both of those films, I think, are pretty incredible films. They could have done a, you know, fictional scripted narrative film about pimps, but I wonder if the legacy of blaxploitation and a complete lack of understanding of pimp culture in white culture at large maybe made them think they need to first educate before they can kind of put it out there.
I mean, I like, once again, we need to get them here to really ask them. But I could say I can only speak from my perspective of someone that does documentaries. You got to have a passion for it. You got to have a passion for the story that you want to tell, because it's a different format than writing a script. you know, you're really dealing with facts, and you still have to create a story that flows and still connects and still educate and still entertain at the same time, and not try to make it come across boring. So with American Pimp, I mean, they went layers deep into it. It kind of reminded me of HBO had a show called Beyond the Pint or something like that. Or it used to come on real late night. And it was like about prostitution and things like that in Jersey. And they kind of went and did the digging as well. But it wasn't the culture that was just predominantly African-American. It was like the whole world of prostitution. So it had females and it was hearing from their side. But American Pimp was only hearing it from the perspective really from the pimps. Mm-hmm, and right. The culture that comes with it. Yeah, I mean, you got Iceberg Slams, you got books, you got all kinds of things that's always been there to educate people on the culture. It's just that, you know, being a tell or creating a documentary, you know, is the visuals of it. And you're hearing it directly from the pimps themselves. So that form of media became something as well that was available maybe for them to tell the film. From that standpoint, where it's more real than it actually being a scripted film, that you hearing it from these guys that, I mean, I remember going out and seeing pimps. Shit, I lived in a block where prostitution was there for years and probably mm-hmm. still is, you know? So I seen it. I seen the culture of it. I mean, I did a project on stripping, you know, because damn near that's the level before you go to prostitution in some in which ways, you know? So I understood the culture. Like, I was in a strip club. I saw it. I was like, fuck, this is a story that needs to be told. So mm-hmm. you surround yourself with the elements of it. And then when you look at their films, definitely that one, I mean, they interview these guys. So the credits show that they actually held the camera and one of the brothers actually did the audio. So it was a dual two guys just in the field doing it. And they probably came back and like, shit, look at this footage we got. Let's put something together. Because sometimes that's how it just starts. It starts with just two people having a conversation. The camera breaks out. We start rolling, and it's like, this is interesting. Let's keep going. Next thing you know, you talk to two more people. You look at something. You see that you have something there. Now you go layers into it and start telling the different stories or the cultures of it. And I feel like when I see that film, they did a great job at it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's I saw the film in 99 or at least around 99. I remember watching it on I believe it was on DVD. And I remember being very taken with these characters. Like they're so large, they're larger than life and they're fascinating people to watch. And I remember quite enjoying the film back then. And this isn't to say that I didn't enjoy it when I watched it yesterday, but it does feel it's complicated to me a little bit. I'm not sure that the way that they necessarily I don't know what the best way to put it is, but I'm not sure that they're being necessarily critical of this lifestyle. It feels a little bit at times as though they. I don't know. I mean, I guess this is more of a question for you, Kirk, in terms of how you sort of perceive from the documentary perspective. Do you feel like they really got to the sort of heart of this world and what motivates these people to do this?
I mean, I feel like at the time that the film was made, in terms of where we are now consciously, that's if you want to go into terms of just sex trade, if you want to go into different layers of things that you could point at, you know, I felt like what they wanted to accomplish was to make you understand. This is just me looking at it. Once again, I got to give you the disclaimer. This is just my perspective. So when I watch it, you got to remember they're young filmmakers at that time. So you're influenced as well by your surroundings. You're in the process of taking it in. So consciously, you may not even be open or aware to different layers because you're learning it. And so maybe they were inspired by what they saw to tell that story. You know, if you ask them now as grown men, you know, their perspective on certain things may change and what stories they may want to tell. You know, they may want to tell from a woman perspective that may have started somewhere and got to where she is, and then maybe on the road of recovery, you know. So you can't, that's one thing about like filmmaking or definitely documentaries, where it's a living, breathing subject matter. You know, your perspective is going to change as you mature as well.
We talked about this. So we did Mr. Death, Errol Morris movie, pretty recently, a couple weeks ago. And we talked about a lot the, you know, the responsibility of the documentarian and intent and all those things. And what I felt with American Pimp, at least, was it was non-judgmental and allowed the subjects to tell their own stories in the way they wanted to tell them. For me, at least, that was a very responsible way in. Not that, you know, part of the point of the conversation was you don't have to be responsible. That's not a necessary aspect to documentary filmmaking, but it felt like it was a responsible way into this world that gave me a good understanding of what was going on without judging positive or negative. I do think that there was some shade thrown at the idea that it's illegal, which is fair. I think that perspective was given voice by a bunch of people in this film. And I think, you know, 22 years later, I think that's a far more widely held viewpoint than it was 22 years ago. So that's a little forward thinking in that respect. But in general, yeah, in the beginning of the film, I did have that twinge of this is all from the pimp's perspective. Yeah. And that is a little disquieting. At the end, I do really feel like it doesn't matter that much. I feel like that was the perspective we were getting. And I appreciated it because it's what's critically important at the end of this film is just how differently it all worked out for all these different guys. Mm-hmm. One winds up in jail, one's still doing it in his 70s, one's working in an office, one's taking his daughter to the park. It contains multitudes like anything else. And I think the characterization of the pimp in American pop culture for the last 30 years, particularly the black pimp, has been incredibly cartoonish and almost embarrassingly cartoonish. And I think this is like, that's why I kind of phrased the question at the beginning about educating. I think it's important to tear down that, you know, that wall and at least humanize these guys in the beginning. And then we could start to understand and debate the merits of what's happening here and, you know, the different sides of the story.
Pimp has been here long before you and I, and Pimp would be here long after you and I are gone. That's just, you know, it's a sad fact, but it's the truth. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, it's you're feeding people's vices, and that's what they do. So as long as that becomes someone's vice and someone's desired, and they have the ability to actually get it and they pay for it, they'll find a way to do it. And there'll also be someone there that also finds a way to actually make money off it. It's just the way in the world we live in. You know what I mean? As much as we want to have this shit perfect, you know, this is just a fucked up cycle for what it is, because you do have people out there broken. You know, when mm-hmm. you really look sure. at the core of it, you're dealing with a lot of broken people, from the pimp all the way down to the woman itself that's out there. You know, so it's deeper than just the culture itself and what it looks like. Because look at the guy that had that little bunny ranch, white dude, right? Ain't a black dude. He's pimping them hoes too. You know, mm-hmm. so pimping don't really have no color. You know, so I mean, trust and believe, this is everywhere. I mean, there's an underworld for different culture when it comes to the sex trade. And, you know, yeah, we got to put a stop on it. Yeah, we shouldn't glorify it. You know, when, like I said, when you look at those films, definitely like the Mac, that's the 70s, you know, and at that time, it wasn't about the drug dealing that were glorified. It was the pimps that were glorified, you know. So those were the things that you saw in the films in the 70s. It wasn't until the 80s that you saw the drugs, and the 90s that you saw films that were based around that and less about pimping, because it wasn't about that anymore. That income became something that was so small, you know. So you're now dealing with the vulnerability of having a woman that could run her mouth, and now you're arrested. and you're looking at X amount of time for that when you could actually sell this product right here and make more money and not have to worry about no one. So the game changed. So a lot that happened in the culture of the underworld when it comes to that. But trust and believe, that shit still exists. You know, it's just different now. I still see them walking up and down the street sometime in D.C. You know, but it wasn't like it was in the 80s. It wasn't, it's not as prevalent that it was seen, but it's now, is the dark web now is called. So it's just, there's just a different form now, you know, and it's more traceable now if you ask me. So eventually everybody get caught.
I just want to give a really quick synopsis just for the people that might not have seen this film. It's a little tough to see this film right now, which is interesting. I'm not sure why it's not released in really any way. It's odd, but it is what it is. Because, the Hughes brothers film this.
It's sex trade. It's a sex trade. I mean, seriously, if you really, I mean, you glorifying sex trade. And in these days and times, you can't have that out there. Just can't. Regardless that you're telling someone's life and their journey, when you really look at the responsibility of what you do as a filmmaker, what are you really putting out there? You know, so like I said, when you look at that film at that time, you know, it was acceptable. But now that won't be acceptable.
That's fair. Let me just very quickly, the synopsis is the Hughes brothers helm this documentary about the state of prostitution in urban sectors of the U.S., producing an ostentatious, profanity-laden celebration of the ghetto subculture of pimping. This film combines images of fictional pimps from film and television with candid interviews with infamous real-life street hustlers from San Francisco's bluesman-turned-pimp Clarence Fillmore Slim Slims to Chicago's pimp-turned-minister Don Magic Juan. American Pimp was screened at the Sundance Film Festival in January of 99. It would screen at various film festivals into 2000 and would eventually get a theatrical release on June 11th, 2000. It would ultimately make $218,000 on a $650,000 budget. It has 52% on Rotten Tomatoes from critics and 72% from audiences. Read two quick little snippets of reviews from Variety. A disappointing documentary debut from the gifted Hughes brothers, a soft, uncritical exploration of pimps that ignores issues of race, misogyny, and violence. Helmer seemed carried away by the exotic lifestyle of this morally dubious profession. And Entertainment Weekly said American Pimp is a supple and engrossing, liquid, smooth street rap testimonial. Still does the movie showcase the survivors of the urban underworld as they actually are? Or are we just staring into their masks? The answer, I think, is both at once, and that's part of the film's intrigue. The Hughes brothers slyly undercut the image of the pimp as Superman, even as they pay tribute to its continuing power as an African-American cultural myth. I would agree more with the Entertainment Weekly review probably than the Variety review, but it is interesting to see that critics were pretty hard on this movie, which I was a little surprised about, but I don't know what you guys thought.
Well, surprised why? Going back to who's the critics? Going back to who's watching it? You know, going back to when they made that film, who was their audience?
Right.
You know, you have an audience of people that, like you said, Bishop Don Juan. I mean, most people knew him from being around Snoop and wearing a green suit and things like that. But some people were introduced to him by seeing him in that doc. Like, I saw him in the dot before I saw him with Snoop. You know, so going back to that whole aspect of when things are made, who do you make it for? You know, so for them, they probably could care less what the critics thought, but probably heard reviews of them being in a community of people like, man, that's the best doc I've seen in so long, man. You hit that on the point. You told the story. You kept it real. And that to them was probably a praise that they really cared about more than people that don't understand the culture, you know, because if you don't understand, you don't understand. Sometimes you got, if you haven't lived it, you can't really experience it.
Right.
That's a really kind of interesting point, kind of a point that I think is an undercurrent of what's happening in culture now, culture at large, of who, not only who is making it, but who they're making it for, like you just said. I do wonder, you know, I sometimes on this podcast rail against the idea of making art films just for other artists, right? things just for your insular community of filmmakers or whatever, and how a lot of people out here feel like, well, it doesn't matter what the masses say. What matters is that, you know, these 40 other filmmaking friends that I have like it. And I think that I'm not into that, basically. I don't think that is not really, to me, the point of art that gets exhibited widely. That's different from what you're saying to me. Mm-hmm. Making something for a culture that is often underserved and even more often presented through a white lens is an important aspect. However, it doesn't change the fact that these films do get exhibited widely and are going to be, you know, engaged with by an audience outside of the culture that the film is made for. So I don't even know. It's more of a discussion than a question, because it's not a matter of judgment or good or bad. But I do wonder how, first of all, you as a documentarian, if you take that into account when you're making your films, because your films largely focus on Black culture in America, right?
Yes, some of it. Yeah, you can say that.
How that informs the way you're making the documentary and how you deal with, you know, critics from outside of your culture. Discussing it, even us. I mean, even us on this podcast. I mean, what's that discussion like?
I would go back to even like my first film and cover everything that we just talked about in terms of this film. The first film that I did as a documentary was The Life of Raphael Redmond, right? Culturally, it's about this guy that's a kingpin in Washington, D.C., right? Made so much money at the time that I'm a teenager, so I'm hearing the names, it's circulating. Mm-hmm. So it becomes that thought as a filmmaker later on the road that this is a story I want to tell. But the process of telling that story, would it be my first doc? No different than that being the Hughes Brothers' first doc. I was really focused about serving the community of people that I knew, right? And telling that story that hasn't been told before. So I wasn't really thinking about outside of DC technically. It wasn't until when we independently released the film, the subject matter was such a subject matter that people wanted to know about that it automatically, organically spread, right? So mm-hmm. It spread outside DC, it started getting bootleg, things like that. And then that turnaround sparked and birthed the American Gangster for BET, right? So understand that when I went at creating something, I didn't go at it with the intentions of it being what it became. I went at it with just letting this story being told to the people that were in my community that just knew it. So when you apply that to being a filmmaker, that's a young filmmaker. You know, when you are in the game longer and you start to understand the power of what you do in terms of making documentaries and making films, it changes your perspective on the stories that you start to tell and or how you tell those particular stories, right? So once again, I don't know with them, but maybe the film was something that was independent with 200 and something thousand and or 600,000, whatever the budget was, and they independently made the film based on the fact that every studio said no. They weren't interested. Yep, right. Or maybe from that perspective because they didn't feel like there was an audience for it, right? But once again, they went out there, made it, and showed that there was an audience to the point that we're at this point talking about the film Yeah, 22 years later, we're talking about something that they put out that, you know, they probably were heard a lot of no's on. So I get it, you know, but I mean, these are things that as a filmmaker, when you go out and do something, everything really, like I say, go back to where you are in life and the maturity level of where you are as a filmmaker. Because for those that came before us that opened the doors and we get guidance for mentorships from, we technically still have to learn it. You know, someone could tell you something a million times and you hear it, but it's not until you really experience it that you really understand it. So maybe they heard from a lot of advisors, nah, it's not a good look. It's maybe not a good look on your career, X, Y, Z, but maybe to them, they's like, it's a culture people I know that. I know this will rock for. And I'm not concerned about the ratings. I'm not concerned about what the reviews will say. I know what these people that I'm making this for will say. Mm-hmm. So I've been on that path before.
Yeah.
I mean, you know? I think that it's, I certainly wasn't trying to, you know, be critical of the film necessarily. I thought it was a very powerful movie, and you know, by the end of it, I really did feel like they, I mean, just even thinking about putting all these people on camera and just sort of it did feel like they were giving us a perspective that we weren't supposed to necessarily have, if that makes sense. Like, mm-hmm. It felt very, I don't want to say it felt dangerous necessarily, but
well, it was dangerous. I love that about it.
Okay. So okay.
Yeah, okay. I love that. That's my favorite aspect about it, because you have all these guys who are engaging in illegal activity, yeah. You know, and totally down to tell their story on camera. That's like, that's thrilling. And I assume that, like, I've never seen that before. I assume that that's never been a thing.
But that came with a value. That came with a lot of trust.
Yes.
You know? So, but that goes back, once again, that goes back to you being embraced by the community. And then when you're embraced by the community, there's a sense of trust. So when that trust is open, you're not going to go out there and mess it up by doing the opposite. So, you know, those guys were open to him because they knew that at the end of the day that, you know, they didn't deal with a crew. You know, mm-hmm. Like I say, I don't think it was 50 people that showed up and they had cameras.
I think it was two of them. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So that kind of just breaks down the wall of how open you're going to be with someone, you know, and talking as well. So, you know, I mean, I would hope that at the time that this was recorded, when they did it, those guys weren't doing it because, yeah, you incriminating yourself in so many which ways, you know? But,
right.
I mean, one of the guys was in jail at the end, you know? And he was talking about, you know, his life decisions, things that he's made. But like I said, man, eventually you're going to get caught. Yeah. You're going to get caught.
I thought that guy was Gorgeous Dre. I felt his story was really powerful. He kind of, at the end, he had the point about, if it wasn't for pimping and hoeing, I wouldn't even be here. Right? Like, this, to your point, the point the film makes, this, to the cliche, the world's second oldest profession, or the oldest profession, the second oldest is motherhood, the oldest is prostitution. So, yeah,
I mean, going back to the culture, Richard Pryor, a product of it.
Mm-hmm.
A product of it.
And then it's like, it goes, I mean, you really, that Variety review kind of bothered me because they say they don't talk about race. I don't even understand that. I don't even understand the logic of that, because one, they don't have to, but two, the juxtaposition between them and the guy that runs the bunny ranch is talking about race, like, explicitly. Yep. It's explicitly talking about the two sets of rules. And that goes back years and years and years and years and years, to the point where now, you know, the bunny ranch is this cute place you go outside of Vegas with at a frat party, and pimp on a street corner like Fillmore Slim is persona non grata to so many people. So it's, yes, that, but I do think the racial aspect of this is incredibly relevant, and just an incredibly relevant, you know, story in terms of all the people that were born out of this, all the people that have been exploited, but exploited where they, because they have nowhere to go. I mean, it was pretty clear. It was pretty interesting how at least half, if not more, of the hoes were white. Yeah. How this job has kind of been sanctioned, like pimping has kind of been sanctioned a little bit, but not all the way. You know, kind of like drug dealing has been sanctioned a little bit, but not all the way. It's been sanctioned in other cultures.
It comes with the culture. Some things are accepted based on it being a part of the culture. You may not agree with it. You know, it's like you got a drunk uncle. You know, you love mm-hmm. him, you know, but you know he fucked up. So, I mean, you could look at it from that perspective as well, where, I mean, you turn your face to it, but at the same time, someone's still being hurt at the other end. You know, and that's the woman that's out there at the same time. She's a mother. She's a sister. You know, there's family that's actually destroyed behind all of this at the same time as well. So it is a domino effect in the community. But there's always a door that you see it. And at the end of the day, it's about money. And people do things because of that. You know, those girls are broken. And then they find someone that finds, I don't want to say they find someone, but they're preyed upon. Best way to look at it. And
it's.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
This goes far beyond, right? This goes far beyond the parameters of American Pimp. This goes far beyond that, right? This is, you know, what's interesting is there are a lot of these guys are living in Hollywood, living in LA, and a lot of the mothers seem to send their children there to go be stars. This is not just about African-American culture. This is about Hollywood culture, the culture of America, the culture of celebrity, exploitation of women, power dynamics. This is, you know, this is just another version, maybe even a less bad version than the Harvey Weinsteins of the world. This is, you know, just another version of the casting couch. I've been listening to the podcast on the woman who was in Star 80, Deborah Strassen, I think, who was murdered by her boyfriend slash pimp. She came out from Arizona. She was in Playboy and she was murdered. This is an old story of exploitation. It's just what's critical about American Pimp is the way black pimps have been demonized forever and ever, or infantilized, right? Or you know, turned into cartoons like Huggy Bear, right? So,
yeah, I mean, they talk about that in the film a little bit, you know, about modeling agencies and how is that any different than the situation that they're in? And you're completely right, Kenny. I mean, this is the commodification of this sort of power dynamic is as old as time, right? I mean, and it's not going anywhere, unfortunately. And I do think that. That's probably another reason why this film is not widely available. Like I can't help but feel like this film is feels like it's, you know, going at topics that people just don't want to talk about.
Wait a minute. What are you saying exactly? So I completely understand. You feel like the film is not being perceived correctly, or you felt like the film is not relevant? What are you saying?
No. I think it is very relevant. I think that the film is. I think part of the reason that it's perhaps one of the reasons why this film is not widely available, I think, is because it's going at things that people are scared of or don't want talked about. I think it's as we talked about earlier. I think that there's an element of danger to it, and that it's going at sacred lambs that people don't want to talk about. And I think to Kenny's point, this idea of sort of the commodification of this type of relationship, or I would say to some degree, men's power over women to some degree, is in many, many industries. I think the film is showing that. I mean, I don't.
Yeah.
I mean,
once again, it shows you a lifestyle that's ugly, man. It's the best way. Yeah. It shows you something that's real. It shows you stuff that exists, and it's either you want to turn and not look at it, or face it for what it is. And then what you had on there were people that were completely honest, that broke down the lifestyle, broke down why they did it, and they told you how just business works. And they use different examples to make you understand that there is a sense of prejudice even in that industry of pimping hoes. You know, going back to Bunny Ranch, you know, this guy has a building and you go there and get the same service. But if that was, you know, an African-American man, would it be viewed the same? You know, we don't know. But when you look at them on the streets, it ain't viewed the same. It isn't. So, I mean, I guess when you look at the word pimp, you look at someone that controls a woman, right? Mm-hmm. That's the first thing that comes to your mind, mind control. You know, anyone could control a woman's body, but could you control a woman's mind? That's the whole saying for a pimp, right? So having a facility like the Bunny Ranch, I mean, they free to come and go, I guess, right? So it's no longer the mind of a man, but pimping now is so different because females pimping themselves. Like I said, you know, it's a different world now when it comes to that pimping mentality. That aspect of walking the street is so old in terms of how things are done now, right? So now behind the scenes are different jacks or different trades, you know? So behind some of this shit is actually police officers, to be honest with you, for shit that I've heard and seen as well, where there's a sense of protection that some of these girls actually feel, knowing that this person is a cop. You know, so you hear about shit like that anyways. Some things like that are revealed. Some things just aren't. But there have been scenarios where prostitution have actually had police involved. So, you know, the same shit they hear to protect us. You know, people corrupt, man. Going back to what I said in the beginning. Yeah. You know, this is a world that you're going to deal with that. You're going to deal with different energy, and different people have different things and different desires and things that they value more than some things that they don't. And for some, based on their outlook on a woman, they see a woman extremely less valuable, you know, and the money's more valuable, and what she could bring is more valuable than her life or actually putting her in danger. But that takes a different type of mindset of a person.
Of course it does. You know? Not everyone becomes a pimp, but like, can't help but also think like it probably looked pretty fucking good. You know what I mean? It probably looks pretty lucrative to be a pimp when they're talking about making $8,000 a night.
Maybe in the 80s.
That's what I'm talking about.
Yeah, maybe the 70s. Yeah, I mean, now it's just pimping is so different because the internet has changed that world and even how they function. You know, you could look at certain websites that they shut down, like Backpage or those other things that you could go to, and the service is right there for you to call up. You know, just like Vegas, they got the little books and walk down the street. There's a book, a goddamn fucking newspaper stand right there for you to pick up. So when you look at all that, the world has changed in even how that's actually been viewed. But once you now involve kids, now once you involve restraining someone and telling someone, you know, you're going to do this, then that changes, you know, because I can tell you now, however you want to look at it, if a woman is dating a guy and she won a meal out of it and she fucked for a meal, she still basically says she sold a pussy for a meal.
Well, however
you want to look at it.
Yeah, well,
so
that's...
prostitution can be viewed on different perspective, however you want to look at it. You know, if we're talking about pimping, that's different.
Massive scale. I totally hear what you're saying, that there's like a massive range of what has been set up as acceptable by this culture and unacceptable, and it's not really clear where it is. It's interesting when you're talking about how the bunnies in the Bunny Ranch can go when they want. But like... maybe they can't. I know that they can. I know that they have, you know, free will, but maybe they can't. You know, maybe that's the only way. And I think that the undercurrent of all this stuff and the undercurrent of everything in the underworld, everything that you ever talk about, underworld crime, organized crime, is financial security, which is just like the most important thing in American life is right. financial security. It's the thing that keeps you mentally well. It's a thing that keeps you psychologically well. It's a thing that puts food on your kids' plates. It's the thing that keeps you out of jail. It's like, so when financial security is presented as you can have it by doing these, you know, illegal slash immoral things, or you can't have it, I do think that there is some inherent manipulation that not the pimps are the ones doing that. Society's the one doing that, right? So that I think that to me, this is such an important movie because it's important to demystify and analyze the people who are doing this from more socially impoverished backgrounds and understand the motivations of what's going on in that and how they relate to society as a whole. So even if this wasn't necessarily meant, and I don't think it was, but even if it wasn't meant for audiences at large, it was made with such craft, care, and non-judgment that anyone who sees it should at least start having some thoughts in their head about the way it relates to society at large.
Yeah, I mean, there are reasons. There are some movies that are pulled, some movies that aren't available for different reasons, right, that I've come across. Like you said, I couldn't find that film in a long time, you know? Mm-hmm. I mean, until when I watched it recently, that's like the first time I've seen it in such a long time, you know, because I thought like, wow, you know, but it took me back to just that culture of understanding it, you know, took me back to me just looking out, being downtown and seeing it. So it's like a time warp at the same time. But at the end of the day, when you look at the core of what the story was all about, it's about prostitution as well. And that's still, mm-hmm. that still goes on, you know, and it's a manipulation and it's, you know, it's everything that goes against what society really stands for to really get at it. And that film just gave you a glimpse of that world because there's so many layers to it. Like, imagine a woman being arrested, going to jail, being processed, and then being released right back out that same night, right? And that happens over and over. Eventually, she's faced a judge. Eventually, she goes to jail. That's another story all within itself of just what will make a woman actually go through all of this and still end up in certain places as well. So, I mean, it's just different layers to this shit, man. It's like pimping is a big business.
Yeah.
And it happens every day. There's different forms of pimping, you know? Different forms.
Yeah.
I mean, what you guys, okay, let me ask you a question. You guys said you guys saw the film when it first came out, right?
I didn't. I saw it for the first time this week.
Really?
Yeah, I saw it back in 99.
Yes, yeah. I saw it for the first time this week.
How did you hear about it?
Oh, I've always known about it. I mean, I've always known it exists because, you know, I love the Hughes brothers, particularly, you know, like their first two films I love. And it has a real fucking ear-catching title, right? American Pimp. You never forget that. But I never watched it. I've never seen it.
See, because probably the reason why you haven't watched it or saw it before is not because of the title. It's just that it wasn't culturally something that you were even interested in at that point. You get what I'm saying?
Well, there's another kind of point you're making, which I think is interesting too, right? Like that, I don't think that was it for me because I've engaged a lot of culture, a lot of entertainment that was, you know, kind of specific for the Black community. It's the other thing that's a little more uncomfortable when I'm looking into myself as to why I've spent so much time, you know, engaging with Black culture in a way that is, you know, voyeuristic and like a tourist. So I definitely I did not watch it because it wasn't like appropriate. Like I feel like people throughout my life would have, you know, absolutely sat down and watched the movie. But I also think that there's always been an exoticism associated with Black culture in America, particularly among young white people, that is something that white people aren't even comfortable engaging with. No, I've said this on the show a lot. I write on a show with a predominantly black cast right now. And one of the black writers on my show had a criticism of another writer, and I won't say anything more about that. But the point was, this person loves black culture, but not black people. And
you can't write no black culture then. How the fuck you going to write black culture but don't understand? But don't
me?
Not you. Just what you just said. Like the
you shouldn't. You shouldn't. You're 100% right. Yes.
That right there is someone is falling asleep at the wheel, right? Because that's a sense of responsibility. Like, it's like actually, like, come on, that's an oxymoron. I don't need to have someone write for something that don't like it. Like, you're going to do no justice by it. We're going to still have that.
It's horrible.
Yeah, we're going to still have that.
And you know, and you know what? It's Aaron Sean Thompson was on our podcast and created SWAT, and he's Phil's friend. And he said, black people write, white people, I think, you know, not unilaterally, but a lot of white people writing black culture, writing stuff, you're writing shows set within black culture is just another example of blackface. And when you say Amos and Andy shit, that's what you're saying too, right?
Mm-hmm. I'm like, listen, did he ever say or she ever say why they don't like black people? That's an interesting thing.
I hope I didn't mischaracterize it. A black writer on our show said this about a white writer. The white writer didn't say she didn't like black people, but it was, you know, it was kind of apparent from years and years and years on the show that if you don't, my sense at least is, if you don't engage with these characters as black people in black culture and just presume that they're, you know, raceless, essentially, you are, you know, you're starting from a place where the whole show better reflect a raceless society. You have to create a Bridgerton-esque simulacrum where race is not a construct. But short of that, you know, life's different. So yes, no one ever came out and said I don't like black people.
No. I get that. It's just if you don't understand it, don't write it. You know, it's like. It's taking on a project. You become responsible for what you paint. You become responsible for what the images that you're putting out there. So don't take shit for a check. You know, don't shortchange the creative process or the story for a check. Because you're not giving yourself justice as well. You know, and then you become labeled as being someone that really doesn't even understand the culture, but just circle around the fucking culture. You know, so... You know, I mean, I get it. You know, hey, you saw it, and you know exactly what it is. So at that point, you are in position to vocally express how you feel about it and to keep it going. You know, but whoever's in charge, hopefully, will see that and address it. You know, for how they see fit, but hopefully, it's done in the right way. Because you can do things tastefully. You know, like if a person doesn't get it, like take them there. I remember one time I had a pitch meeting and it was a project and I basically asked the person, I said, have you ever went to Compton before? And they said, no. I said, then fuck it. How are you going to do a project about a community and you never been there before? So I took that pitch meeting in the car and we drove through Compton and I walked through the streets. Like I'm not even from Compton, but I know at the same time, you could just go in a community. It all depends on how you present yourself, right? Because, I mean, the commonality is that we're black, right? So I know I would know how to deal with my kind, if that makes any sense, you know, in a community that I'm entering into that I know I'm not from, right? So, I mean, I went to the school, took her there. We went into the school. A game was going on. Like, she experienced it from a perspective of understanding a little bit more. And that was like 4 hours. But that was like one of the best pitch meetings that she ever had based on the fact that it left the office and it went into the street. So you can understand exactly the project that you're going to do, you know. And I feel like if you're a writer and you're doing a project on anything, take that person to that environment. You know, that's what the Hughes brothers did when you look at American Pimp. In order for you to understand, we're going to take you to the pimp. We're going to take you into their world. They're going to tell you about it. You know, it's a difference of them coming into your world and telling you. But if you are a bug on a wall, and that's truly what that film was, you know, going back to the film, it was, they were a bug on it. We were a bug on the wall observing, and we didn't like the shit that we saw based on the fact that you see people being harmed in some English ways. But at the same time, you couldn't stop looking at the shit because you want to see what's going to happen next. And as we get closer to the end, I love what they did. They told you, look, this guy went to jail, just such and such. You know, I lost everything. You know, I went into it with a bankroll and I came out with nothing. So, listen, man, when you do wrong at the end of the day, don't last long. I keep on going back to that because that's just my motto when it comes to the facts of life. You know, they say karma's a bitch, but that shit doesn't, that she comes quick.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so when you do, and just something different about energy now in the world and how we feel and how we're vibing, you know, you could see it that even we're going back to George Floyd, you saw so many people come out and protest. Like, we're in a place of healing right now. Like, the world is going to do something different that a film like that can't survive now at all. That's my opinion.
But it should. It should, because I think you're, I think you really just made the point about why it should. With, you know, first of all, the story about you taking the exec to Compton is incredible and big-hearted, right? That's a really big-hearted thing to do that I'm not necessarily sure that that executive deserved such big-heartedness. But it's really wonderful that you did that. And I do think that's actually what the Hughes brothers were doing here. Whether they intended to or not, I do think that there was some intent to that, but whether they intended to or not, like, you can't, there's been so much demonization of Black culture, and the pimp has been held up, the pimp and the welfare queen has been held up by so many people as the hallmark example of where Black people have gone wrong in this country. And it's based on virtually nothing. It's based on Ronald Reagan and Lee Atwater yelling about it. It's very important, I think, to at the very least allow Black people to tell their own stories. And then you can start having a conversation.
I feel like we're doing that now. And I feel like we're doing it now. And I would say that now than before, because the accessibility now is there for people to tell their story, you know. And yeah, there's different forms of, some people may not even be filmmakers. They just have a camera and they want to go out and shoot and they feel like this is the way how they tell the story. But of course, you and I understand there's fundamental ways of structures and things like that. And eventually that just comes with education, you know, eventually that comes with time. And, you know, with YouTube University, and all the things that's going on now with just younger generation of kids coming up and learning how to make films. Because when we first started Guaranteed, I mean, if you wasn't editing on Avid, it wasn't considered a movie. If you weren't shooting on 35 or damn near Super 16, no one was interested in looking at it, right? So we've came a long way in terms of how we even accept media, right? So now you have so many different filmmakers that are popping up that are really actually raising the bar and telling our stories at the same time. And I see that and I commend that, you know. So the world's changing and, you know, people are starting to see different cultures more than anything.
Mm-hmm. Well, I know you need to run, Kirk. So I wanted to, we do a rating system on this podcast where we rate films from 0 to 99. And I'm interested to hear where from, you would put this
from
film.
1 to 99?
Yeah,
that's a big range. That's the big range. Like, damn. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
We want to make it as hard for you as possible. That's
so. Where do I rate the this film?
Yeah.
Right. So, but we do it when you saw it first in 99.
Yeah.
Before the podcast and then after the podcast. So it's three ratings. Okay.
Well, I can't.
All right.
I think when I saw the film the first time, I would probably mindset of where I was at too. Like, you know, this is 99. I mean, I'm a wild dude in 99. So, you know, it's not that I was consciously where I'm at now and just being an adult, but back then 99, I'm in college. you know, and hip hop and pimping and all that shit was going on. Like, man, listen, if I didn't have to get on this call in 2 minutes, I got a pimping story as well in terms of, yeah. You know,
you leave us hanging like that. You're gonna
shit
say
that I never told before, but
we got to bring you back. Then we'll figure it out.
So at that time, I think it was one of those type of films that, you know, it was a documentary. It was a different form as well. It wasn't a movie for us, so we saw it and we took it like the news. Sure. So the perspective of it was more like, this is shit's accurate. You know, this is what's really going on. No different than other documentaries at the time of drug dealing and things like that. So there was a sense of familiarity of seeing it.
Sure.
Okay, now I understand it. So I gave it a higher rating back then. And now looking at it as a filmmaker and a mature person, I would love to have seen different dynamics of it, right? But that's me looking at it now and seeing it now from that perspective. But I would probably give it 85 and 99, and yeah. I probably at this point will. I gotta be fair, I probably give it a 75. I wouldn't drop it down that more. I would just say,
everyone on this podcast comes on and they're all babies and they're giving their films 99s and shit. Yeah. So good for you.
I gotta jump on the Zoom shit real quick for another call, man. Look, I really appreciate this, man. I love the vibe, I love the energy. I love to come back, talk some more shit, you know, but
we would love to have you.
I do have a story that when we get back on that pimping shit, I do have a story to tell you. I just didn't get a chance to go around because we was really on some moral compass shit at this moment. But there's a whole lot of shit that I can tell you that I've experienced, that I've seen, that I've dealt with, you know, but it just wasn't in my card or in my soul
for me to do that.
You know,
we'll get you back.
The opportunity presented itself. I was called daddy. I just couldn't do All right, I gotta get on this job, but let's do this again though.
Great to talk to you. Sure.
All right,
we'd love to.
All right, thanks.
So that was great. We lost Kirk as mentioned on the podcast. He had to go sell some show or something. Fantastic guest, obviously, but Phil and I wanted amazing. But Phil and I wanted to also rate this as well. So I'll go first or second. I never saw this before. Having seen it this time after watching it, I gave it a 77. And mostly because I thought it started super strong, ended super strong, and hammocked in the middle. It did really pick up steam like the last half hour, but there was a lot of fat in the middle of this film that didn't make it the world's greatest watch. But 77 is reflective of what I think is, you know, what I thought was a really strong documentary. I think after talking to Kirk, I'm going to go up, even though his grade wasn't quite this high. I'm going to go up. I'm going to go up to an 82. I do think there's a lot more here than I had realized, and any movie that can kind of spur the conversation we had, which I thought was a really, really wonderful, enlightening, relevant conversation, deserves to be at least in the 80s. Phil, how about you?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I had a bit of a like roller coaster in terms of the ratings with this film for me. I saw it in 99, as I mentioned up top in the episode. I really enjoyed it in 99 or around 99, whenever I saw it. But I also felt like I'm just not looking through the lens of a person I am now, right? Like I was 19 or 20 years old, living in fucking Toronto suburbs. And I see this movie, which is completely outside any of my purview, with these larger than life characters. And I was really kind of taken away with that. Then I watched the documentary again before our podcast, and I, similar to yourself, found myself sort of feeling like starts really strong, ends really strong. In the middle, you start to wish there was a little bit more of a narrative, like a little bit more of like a POV of a person that was pulling you through the whole thing. That's not to say that we don't have a bunch of POVs, but I felt like in the middle, I felt a little unmoored, I guess is maybe the best way to put it. And then we had this fantastic conversation with Kirk, and it made me go back up again. Like, I think I'm probably in 99. I was probably in like the low 70s. Similarly, I think I was probably around there before we talked about it. And then after this conversation, I think I'm probably around an 80 as well with you, in the sense of like, not only did it open great conversations, but I felt like, you know, Kirk gave me a perspective I just didn't have, you know, and don't have. And that really changed the way that I saw the film. So, I mean, I think that the thing that I took away the most from what Kirk was saying was how realistic this film is. I know that's a kind of ridiculous thing to say about a documentary, but like, not all documentaries are particularly realistic. Mm-hmm. And I think that this film, the access they got to these people, really does put you in this world, like in a way that you know, I certainly never have been before. So I was really impressed with it.
Cool. Phil, what do we do next week?
Well, we're doing everyone's favorite Universal Soldier movie. We're doing Universal Soldier 2.
there are 5 Universal Soldier movies?
Yes.
It's really got the Mission Impossible trajectory, right? Where the first one is like fine.
Sure.
And the second one is like a, you know, disaster. And then I've never seen 3 through 14, but our guest, Tom Lorenzo of the You're Missing Out podcast, says like 3, 4, like they're masterpieces, apparently.
He raves about them. Makes me want to watch them, quite frankly.
And you know, the director of 3 and 4 just put out a film this year that was really well regarded.
Yep.
Do you remember what that was? A small,
I don't remember off the top of my head, but
I'm going to find out. It's a low budget film that was super well regarded. I'm sure I can find it. But
Tom was an amazing guest.
He's
super
awesome.
Excited to have him come back. He's going to come back for some other films we have him, and just not just a joy of a person, but just like, totally the very opposite direction from what we just did with American Pimp. But like, this guy has seen all of these movies. Do you know what I mean? Like, he's seen all the films that I generally have not. And that's not
Tom has seen every movie ever made.
It's amazing. It's incredible.
I am blown away by his encyclopedic. I mean, he does a podcast with McNally and the two of them together. I am blown away by how much they know about film history. I don't know how they even get the time. They're both like, you know, 29.
But I also think that, and I agree with what you're saying, but I also think that like Tom has a specific taste. Do you know what I mean? Like, anyone who follows him on Twitter knows that like, he's a little bit of an iconoclast. He likes to, you know, he likes to stir the pot from time to time. But like, he also he really loves movies that might not necessarily get the love they deserve. And I think that's why I was excited to have him on for this, not a particularly great movie, but I'm excited to have him on for future movies and to have his perspective.
The movie, the director is Peter Hyams. The movie was Alone, and apparently it has just gotten, you know, it's just an incredible movie. And you hear it when Tom talks about it, that this guy really, Peter Hyams, really seems to know what he's doing. Meanwhile, whoever directed Universal Soldier 2 did not, but I liked it more than you guys. I like a good JCVD.
I had never seen the first one. You had seen American.
I watched the first one a couple of days before, which I thought it was a great movie. I mean, it's
a great movie.
It's a bad version of you saw Universal Soldier 1.
I watched it before watching the second.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's a bad Terminator. It's a bad Predator. It's a bad. It's Jean-Claude Van Damme. But and I mean that the way you think. But it's I didn't think Universal Soldier was that bad, guys. I don't know.
I'll say this about the first one. I remember the first one being a big deal. It's Roland Emmerich's first film. You know, he obviously became quite a very successful filmmaker. I guess I don't know my JCVD is really kind of what it comes down to. So, but I'm excited to watch Sudden Death.
Not a bad blind spot.
You talked about Sudden Death being.
Oh, Sudden Death is great. Sudden Death is a 10. Yes, Sudden Death is fantastic. So watch Sudden Death. Yeah,
watch Sudden Death and watch some Universal Soldier.
It's so cool we're doing Universal Soldier 2. We don't give a shit.
That is, I agree. It is great that we're doing it and we don't give a shit.
We'll see y'all next week. Rate, review, subscribe. Thank you to our friends.
One last thing. Please rate, review, and subscribe. Speaking of subscribing, check out our Patreon on all the best films of 1989. Batman, When Harry Met Sally, Fabulous Baker Boys, Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, Ghostbusters 2, Field of Dreams, Major League, and many, many more. We are covering all the best films of 1989 with amazing guests like Joanna Robinson, Liz Hanna, Hunter Covington, Brian Cogman, David Iserson, and many, many more. All your favorite guests from our 1999 podcast are coming on to the 1989 Patreon. You can sign up for it at patreon.com/podcastlikeit's1989. For only $5, you get access to all of these awesome episodes. And for a few bucks more, you get video of our 1999 episodes as well. Plus, there are other very cool tiers too, where you can even be a guest on our podcast. Please check out our Reddit as well at reddit.com/podcastlikeits. We're also on Twitter at podcastlikeits1999. We're also on Instagram at podcastlikeits1999. Thank you so much to Ernie and Will for producing our episodes, Sullivan for our social media, Jan Katas for our amazing art and theme songs. And most of all, thank you all for listening. It's 1999. Podcast like it.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.